Wayne and I have had the privilege of going to a number of poor countries around the world, talking about why poor countries remain poor, systematic poverty, why poor countries remain poor, or look at that differently, systematic wealth and prosperity, why countries grow. The issue we're going to get to today a little bit, and we need your help, is Africa is a whole different continent than the other continents. Let me explain why, and then we're going to go back and do some housekeeping. We've got to look at price supports. There's just a couple things like that, and then we're going to get to the lesson. But if you go to this handout here, and you go to the back of the first page, and go to the last paragraph. Now, this is Africa. This last paragraph is Africa. And you tell me that this doesn't set a set of difficulties. Cultural values that favor ambiguity, a roundabouts, prefer doing it tomorrow, imprecise, randomness, symbolism, fatalism, animistic, superstition, and lots of taboos. I got to tell you that that set of thoughts are very unhelpful when trying to create prosperity in a continent. But from those set of those ideas come economic explanations, and here's the ones we hear all the time: explanations of exploitation, colonialism, anti-capitalism, and greed. And so those are the problems, those are the reasons, those are the economic escalations, and it almost always leads to what? Policies of bigger welfare programs domestically and bigger foreign aid programs internationally, which in our opinion only perpetuates the poverty cycle. The politics of envy, it seems, is unproductive and divisive. So that's where we're going to go today. But way, way before we get to that point, we're going to do some other things. And one of them is we're going to get to price supports in just a second. But there's something else going on. It fits in with our study on Philippians that we're doing from the main pulpit in this church. And that is Pope John Paul II is being beatified this week, or this weekend. He already has been. And what they're doing is making John Paul II into a saint. And I just get a little bit of a smile on my face when I think of it, because I think that's quite wonderful for sure. But isn't it interesting that we are all saints to begin with? I mean, we know Christ. Those of us who know Christ, we're saints. And so we show it in Philippians today, right off the bat in Philippians chapter 1. But you don't have to turn to these, but Psalm 31:23 says, "Love the Lord, all you his saints." Psalm 97:10 says, "The Lord is preserving the life of his saints." Matthew 27:52 says, at the crucifixion, the curtain was torn, the earth shook, the rocks split in half, and the tomb opened, and the bodies of the saints, fallen asleep, were raised. Romans chapter 1, verse 7 says, "You who were called to Jesus Christ, who are loved by God and called to be saints." So, example after example. I'm not going to give you any more. I'll give you the last one that I wrote down this week. Ephesians 4:12. "And he gave to the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, the teachers, to equip the saints for the work of the service. So, they're beatifying Pope John Paul II. And so we can have all kinds, those of us who are non-Catholic, we have thoughts about that process. Those of us that are Catholics have a little bit different view perhaps. But I've got to say this for this magnificent Polish Pope who became the Pope in 1978 and then returned to Poland in 1979. And here's why that was such a big deal. He returns to Poland to give a speech, and they were expecting a few thousand to attend. In fact, out in the square, millions of people came to see the Pope give this speech in communist Poland. And the next day, in the communist newspapers, they showed a half a dozen people standing in the mud listening to the Pope. Six, eight people standing in mud listening. Well, millions were there and saw it the day before. And then they begin to say lies. Lies, lies. All this government is about is lies. And that was the beginning of the end for the Communist Party. Always perpetuating lies. I don't mean to make a big case out of this, but when Glenn Beck was in the Washington Mall last June, those of you that were there, there were over a million people in the mall. And the New York Times said a few thousand. Isn't that cute? Well, here's what the people said in the mall as the Pope John Paul was standing there. We want God. We want God. And that was the cry from the Polish heart. Communism, abolish God. Communism, abolish private ownership. And they said, we want God. And here's what the Pope said in that speech. The great work of God is man. And the great redeemer of man is Christ. Christ cannot be left out of history. To exclude Christ is a crime against God, man, and history. And so that was a direct quote from the Pope's speech that he gave in Poland in 1979. Millions heard it. They loved it. They figured out that communism was a lie and a joke. In 1981, Pope John Paul II was shot, almost killed, in a hospital for a while, got out of the hospital, and went directly to the prison to find the man that shot him to say, you are forgiven. You are forgiven. But Pope John Paul II, if he's known for anything, if you know a person on the planet that has done more to fight abortion, please let me know who it is. All through his life and when he's near death, here's his last speech. He had Parkinson's, terrible Parkinson's, at the end of his life. And here's his sentence. We are weak. We who are weak, imperfect, and in pain are part of the human race too. We are worthy of God's love. Over and over, Pope John Paul II argued for the weak, for the wounded, and the unborn. Was there a greater fighter of abortion than Pope John Paul II? And so this weekend, he was beatified by the Catholic Church. The next order of business is price controls. I'm going to do this a little bit different. I just stand in awe of my brother Wayne Grudem. I stand in awe of his humility. I stand in awe of how does Wayne write a paragraph and it is a good paragraph. How is it that I write a paragraph and to say that it's crappy is to say the least. And so then I rewrite it and it's better. And then I rewrite it again, and it's better. I would never say in a million years that even at the end of my process, it reaches what Wayne seems to be able to do in one paragraph. But you know, when you write books that are 700, 800, 1,200, 1,300 pages long, you can't be fooling around very much. writing and rewriting and rewriting. You either write it or you don't write it. And Wayne writes it. And we have so much fun in the Q&A period where questions are asked, and Wayne always lets me go first. And I said, Wayne, you should go first because you answered so well. And he says, no, no, no. He said, you'll answer three questions that they didn't ask, and then I'll answer the question that they did ask. And so they get four for the price of one. So that has worked out fairly well. Well, so wouldn't you know, maybe your question really is not about price supports. All I can say is about price supports is, look it. The market is not perfect because human beings are not perfect. We are fallen creatures. This is a fallen world, as we're going to see just in just a second, right at the top, laying out the principles as we start to look at Africa. We are fallen people, and we're a fallen world. And therefore, fallen people are not necessarily going to come up with right answers all the time. But the market is just simply a bathroom scale telling you what you weigh. You get up on it, and it tells you. But the market is more than that. It's billions of people coming together, interacting, supply and demand, determining price, and that price telling us what to do. The price, if it's higher, we buy less. If it's lower, we buy more. The price, if it's higher, the supplier will supply more. He loves supplying more at a higher price. If the price is lower, he supplies that. So it tells both buyers and sellers, supply and demand, what to do. So that's all the market is. And so the market is really a billion bathroom scales, a billion every second. And so it is beyond human comprehension. The market is a miraculous instrument of communication. The market is a stupendous transmitter of opinions, billions of opinions, while determining value. Yep, on the scale, that's what I weigh. And it does that a billion times a second, 24 hours a day. It makes a seven wonder of a world like the Grand Canyon seem small by comparison. And therefore, when you have that process happen and a price being determined, when government steps back and says, no, we are going to subsidize. That's not the right price. We're going to give more. Or we're going to add tariffs. Or we're going to set a minimum wage law. Understand what the government's doing. It's taking a million billion decisions and saying, we know better. And it always comes from a good heart. It takes a good heart to say, no. No, the minimum wage is not going to be $5.50 an hour. No one can do a living wage at $5.50 an hour. So, we're going to pass a government law that the minimum wage law has to be $8.50 an hour. Now, look, that's a good heart that wants that. It's got to be $8 an hour because we got to get that wage up. The market is messing up. $5.50 an hour for that starting person at McDonald's or Wendy's or at Burger King or any other place. No, that is not fair. See, always use it's not fair. It's got to be. And so it sounds so good on its face. Yes, let's pay an $8.50 an hour minimum wage. By the way, though, if $8 is good, why not 10? Why not 20? Wait. Why not we pass a law, you have to pay everybody $100 an hour? Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's 10 times better than $10 an hour. Yes. $100 an hour. There it is. But we don't do that, do we? We know that is absolute foolish. The market only pays $5 an hour because that's what they're worth. $5. Incoming person, 16, 18 years old, don't have a work ethic yet, might not show up, have no experience, no talents yet, blah, blah, blah. No. The market says it should be $5 an hour. Oh, no. We're going to pass an $8 minimum wage. So then when we do that, guess what happens? Ed over here sits and government passes an $8 an hour. So instead of in all his hamburger shops, not that he has any anymore, has a bunch of hamburger shops and having kids come in and mix melted mulch shakes and everything at $5 an hour, he just eliminates that, buys the machinery. The machinery mixes the shakes. Those people are not hired. So the very people that you're trying to help with an $8 an hour wage, the very people you're trying to help don't get hired. So I guess it's better to have no job at all at $8 an hour than to have a job at $5 an hour. But that's exactly what happens. That's the unintended consequence. And you bring that to their attention. And they fumble and they jumble, but it's just absolutely... So when you start messing with the market and start thinking you have better ideas and it should be this or it should be that. So, which leads me, you didn't ask the question, but we're going to talk about right now. Messing with the market again. And this is with the... We have a situation for all of us, the high price of food. Food prices are going up, and they're going up very strongly. Why? Thanks for asking. Because government is messing with the market. How is government messing with the market? Friends, for many agricultural products, meats for sure, but cereals for sure, but a lot of products very dependent on grain. Government comes and George Bush and President Obama says we're going to have $22 billion of biofuels by a certain date. And so we're going to start converting some of our corn crop into biofuels. Oh my goodness, what in heaven's name are we thinking? But that's indeed what we go do. So, 36 billions of alternative fuels, and all the companies that are going to produce this biofuel are going to get subsidies. How much? $5 to $8 billion a year of subsidies to produce biofuels. End result, 40% of the corn crop of America and the world go into biofuels. Now, what do you think is going to happen to the beef farmer and to the hog farmer when the price of... So, the price of wheat, the price of corn, the price of corn used to be always hang in there between $2.50 and $3.50 a bushel, and kawam, the price of corn is $7.50 cents a bushel to $8.50 a bushel. So now you think a hog farmer, when his main input is feeding pigs corn, can make it? No, they're going out of business one right after another. Oh, what happens to the price of bacon? I'll give you the numbers if you don't mind. Today, $4.54 a pound. Last year at this time, $3.59 a pound. 10 years ago, $3 a pound. Hamburger today, $2.72 a pound. A year ago, $2.27, and 10 years ago, $1.74. How can it be otherwise? If you're going to take the corn, instead of feeding it to the pigs, you're going to make biofuel out of it. You pull it out, and it drives the price up. And so we're having food prices rising across the board by this biofuel madness, I call it. Now, I'll be honest with you. I'm not very popular in Iowa, Indiana, and in the Corn Belt. I used to give tremendous amounts of speeches in the Midwest. I'm an old farm boy from Colorado, born and raised on the farm for 18 years. We had a feedlot. We had six cows that we milked. We had 160 acres that we farmed with sugar beets, corn, beans, etc. And so I related to people from Nebraska and Indiana and the Corn Belt, Iowa. That was my audience. Not anymore. Not anymore. Now, so, in fact, let's talk about that a little bit. Wayne Grudem can teach week after week, year after year, and you at the end of the process, you love him even more than less. Trust me on this one. The more you would listen to me, you would love me the lesser, because I can tick everybody off in a period of an hour. If I'm really, really going to be truthful, and I'm in Indiana, and I'm in Iowa, and I'm talking about biofuels, I've just got to be honest. The agriculture price supports. You heard Wayne talk about it last week. I chipped in my 2 bits worth. It's a horrendous mistake to do this, to subsidize, to give my aunts and uncles in the state of Colorado sugar beet price supports. What? Why do we have to tax everybody to support my aunts and uncles? Oh, and sometimes we not only support them to grow sugar beets, we support not to grow sugar beets. How's that? A nice check for not producing. That's what any economist would say. That's productivity. Paying people for not to work. You know, when you pay people not to work, listen to this, listen to this. This is profound. When you pay people not to work, they don't work. Crazy idea. Economics is about incentives, harnessing the power of incentives to produce, to create, to become entrepreneurial. That's what economics is about, harnessing the power of incentives. And we're going to pay people not to produce, or about as bad, we're going to pay price supports to keep you in the corn business, to keep you in the sugar business, to keep you in the peanut business. But that's what we do. Government always. You think government is stupid? Their palms are soft, their grip lacks clout, yet they win votes with each hand out. There are more corn farmers than pig farmers. You figure it out. Are we going to screw the pig farmers and by benefiting the corn? This is easy. Localize the benefits, diffuse the costs. It's a majority game, 51% rules. It was James Madison who said, we've designed this government to protect freedom from democracy and the individual from the majority. And they were scared to death. An election is just two wolves and one sheep voting on what we're going to have for dinner. You know darn well what the wolves are going to vote. Sheep, you lost. Pig farmers, you lost. And they get away with it because the costs are distributed so evenly. But now, where are we? Well, where are we? Here's where we are. Food prices going up. Energy prices going up. And someone will be made to pay. It blows me away that President Obama, we have enormous oil in Alaska, but we don't drill. Enormous oil in North Dakota, and only lately have started drilling. Stop drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, blah, 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 blah. And now we're kind of wondering why oil prices continue to go up. Well, I can only say to you that a government just adds one mistake on to another. The Federal Reserve leaves interest rates at 1% or less. Now, if you're a business and you want to borrow, that's very nice. Very nice. But the problem here, when you keep the interest rates very low, is no one is interested in holding dollars. They're not worth anything. So we will go to other currencies around the world, certainly not the dollar. So the dollar continues to fall. Now here's the problem. Strong countries are not built on weak currencies. So just this week, Bernanke said, we're going to be there to support the dollar. This administration believes in a strong dollar. Excuse me! If you believe in a strong dollar, then you will begin allowing interest rates to begin to rise to attract people to the dollar, not away from the dollar. So that's the first part. Plus, when the dollar tanks, when our importing becomes very, very expensive, driving up prices across the board. And on top of all of that, doing everything wrong, the government decides, you know what we're going to do a few months ago? We're going to do quantitative easing number two, QE2 it's called, or for laymen, we're going to go ahead and print about $1 trillion worth of money and get it out there. Quantitative easing. Increasing the money supply. Well, what has to happen when you do that? Every time. Inflation is a monetary policy. Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. The only way you can justify printing $1 trillion is, do I have $1 trillion worth of production? Now you've got the production to match the increase in the money supply and prices stay stable. But if you don't do anything to increase the production side and you increase the money supply, too much money chasing too few goods called inflation. It's happened since the beginning of time. I'm not making this up. This is the way economics works. The money supply is directly related to the inflation rate. So Bernanke apparently is saying America is so deep in debt, we're going to have to inflate our way out of this, which means clipping your coupon year after year after year, making your currency worth less. You can't add $1 trillion of money into the money supply without paying a horrific price. So we're seeing it already. Food prices up. Energy prices up. Everything is going to be going up. When you don't have the right problem identified, when you have a political party that keeps thinking that what we need is more spending instead of less government spending, we need more debt instead of less government debt, you're really looking at it in two different ways. There are groups of people that say, no, we really do need less government spending and less taxes, which creates incentives for all the producers to produce. Now, then when they produce, then and only then can you add to the money supply. The whole trick here is add to the money supply at about the same rate as we have production in the economy. So if we have a 3% increase in the economy, we want about a 3% increase in the money supply. And that's the way it works. But if we keep taxing people, which drives production down, and then adding money to the money supply, which takes the money supply, you're just going at absolute cross purposes is what's going to happen, and inflation is going to be the name of the game. Okay, that was all for free. That was all for free. Now, as Wayne and I are sharing with any country, these are kind of some principles that we want them to know, and then we're going to get to Africa. Quickly, on the first page then, this is God's world, not ours. The earth is the Lord's, and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. So here's our point. Individuals own legal property, but God holds ultimate title on everything. Yep, that is the truth. So we're endowed by our Creator, not by politics, government, wealth, or education. We're created in God's image. We're to be fruitful and multiply. And since we're endowed by our Creator, since we're created in the image of God, every individual has dignity, every individual has value, every individual has worth. Powerful, powerful. As stewards, we're responsible how we treat the earth and use it. God saw everything He made and said it was very good. Third paragraph. God intends for us to use and transform the natural world around us for good purposes. Adam and Eve were put in the garden and told to tend and watch over it. You look at Genesis 2, verses 15 through 16. Man is put into the garden to work and keep it. The term work denotes preparing and tending. Now watch this. This command comes before Adam had sinned. Work did not come as a result of sin, nor is it something to be avoided. Productive work is part of God's good purpose for man in creation. Working and transforming the earth is part of God's blessing. The world is good, but it is fallen. It was created, is now subject to futility. The whole creation is groaning in labor pains right up until the next coming of Christ. We mess things up, we pollute, we act irresponsible. Sinners all, for sure. When I say sinners all, now let's make sure we get this. You, when you sin, you're liable to say about yourself, "Oh, I'm such a sinner." And indeed you are, and indeed I am. But please, this point now has got to be understood. God does not see His saints. He does not see you anymore as a sinner. He sees you as a saint who sins, no doubt about it. But He no longer sees you as a sinner. You are a saint. He sees you with a new heart. So you must, and I must, we must begin to see ourselves as saints that sin, not a bunch of sinners. Because God doesn't deal with us that way anymore. There, chapter 8 of Romans 1, there is therefore now no condemnation to them who are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit in Christ has made us free from the law of sin and death. God does not see us as sinners anymore. We are men and women who continue to sin, but we're saints. And so, how do we walk? Here's how we walk. Trust. Trust. Do we all want to sin less? Of course we all want to sin less. But can I manage your sin, or can you even manage your sin? No, you cannot manage your sin. So what's left is grace, more trust, more faith. God opposes the proud, gives grace to the humble. The key into this all is humility. We can tell if you're humble or not. You can check your own meter whether you're humble or not. I guarantee you, you're not humble if you're going around telling people you are humble. I am humble. What's that? No, that's not the meter. That's not the meter. But if you're trusting self, if you really live a whole day without thinking about God, you're just busy about the tasks of life, and you spend that day and you don't think about God, I got to tell you what's going on there. You are not then, you're not thinking about God. You just admitted it. No, I don't think about it. You're not trusting Him. You're trusting who? You. You trust you? Guess what? You're proud. There it is. So easy to do. But God says He opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. And without faith, we cannot please God. We cannot please God. So the way we please is trust. And faith. And by the way, all this is about grace. Our salvation is about grace. Our sanctification is about grace. You think my flesh has the power to say no to sin? My flesh, Barry? Are you kidding me? But God's power in me has the power to say no to flesh. I am so excited about what we're going to be doing the next months. Where did I put my notes? There it is. In Philippians, from the main pulpit, you know what we're going to be doing? We're going to making practically true what is positionally true. Positionally, we're saints. Positionally, we can't be ripped out of God's hand. He's got us. Positionally, we have absolute, ultimate salvation in Him, no matter what. In this grace, no matter what I do, does not change God's love or grace to me, or what I don't do changes His love or trust for me. So, as Jamie put it this morning, we're going to try to take what we know is positionally true and make it practically true. Because, see, here's where we have a little problem. I say you're saved. I say you have a new heart. I say you're God's woman. You're God's man. Blah, blah. I say all that. And you say in your mind, yeah, but man, you don't know what kind of struggles I'm going through right now. Holy smokes. And I'm anything but a saint. I am a sinner. Don't do it. Don't call yourself that. Yes, you sin. You are a saint with a new heart. Begin to see yourself that way. That's what Jamie's going to do for the next 12 weeks, to make practically true what we already know is positionally truth. We are positioned. We have total, total salvation in Him. No works on our own. We are going to come into heaven to be with Him. It's eternal. It's not going to be torn away. It's not going to be taken away. Now we have to make that practically true. True communion. Eternally minded, persevering, humility, joyful, contentment. The mark of a Christian, love and contentment. So no matter what has happened to us this last 2 or 3 years, and it's been like a tsunami. Last night, my dad and Mandy, my wife and I, went out to eat at Wally's. That's a restaurant. That's one of them is on 44th and Camelback, but this one is on Doubletree, just down the street from the Hyatt Regency Gainey Ranch on Doubletree. And we pulled up to to Wally's. Every single store in that whole shopping center has been closed down and is empty. 15 stores. Here's Wally's on the corner. We drove out of Wally's, empty, 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 empty. Turn, coming down, empty, 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 empty. Turn down this way, a bigger one, empty, 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 15. So don't say that this hasn't been a tsunami that has busted through our community. I mean, it absolutely has. I'm in a Bible study with a friend I dearly love. And he used to be a millionaire. And now he's a pooronaire. P-O-O-R. What do you call? He's a pennionaire. It is so fun to visit of what it's like to be a millionaire and what it's like to have nothing. I'm not asking that God take me to nothing. That's not my prayer. God, now let's test this out. Take me to nothing. I'm not asking for it. But I hope if He would, that I would be no different than I was the day before. The mark of a Christian is love and contentment. I've learned to live with a little. I've learned to live with a lot. But in all circumstances, I've learned to be content in whatever God has provided me. and gives me. Because now get it right. We said right here at the top of this, God has title to everything. It's all His anyway. Who am I thinking? Sorry, I got off on that one. Okay, here we go. So there we are. There we are. And now, so we wrap up those. The world's fallen, and now, now start getting yourself into saying, I want to go to Papua New Guinea. I want to go to some countries in South America. I want to go to a lot of Eastern European countries. I want to go to anyone in Africa. And how can we help? What might be the things that we could do to help facilitate what a lot of Africans might want? Well, watch these last two paragraphs of the first page. If you want to change the world, you eventually have to change how people behave. And if you want to change how they behave, you have to change how they think. Now, can you name a better book in the whole world than the Bible to change how both men think and how they behave? Wow. Here's what we've found out for sure. Facts, fear, and force don't change anything. But God's Spirit does work. People don't resist change. They resist being changed. But they have a sin nature. And when you have a sin nature, you resist being changed. God can change that. So when I got to speak to you all last time on Muslim and how many millions of people are coming to the Muslim faith without a Bible and without a teacher, just simply in a dream and a vision. Dear friends, we've got to conclude, God is a big God. God is a big God. He can handle this, thank you. You don't have to. God will get Himself into everybody's heart and give people a chance to make a decision for or against Him. So God's Spirit works. Top of the back page. Search for the bright spots. Make right behaviors a little easier, wrong behaviors a little bit harder. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Look it. With human beings, when you set up huge hurdles, the average human being cannot jump that hurdle when it's a real tall one. But if you can get that hurdle down, they can get over that hurdle. And then once you get over that hurdle, you gain strength, and maybe the next time it can be just a little bit higher. Keeping things simple, shrinking change. Example, if you were going to come in to Phoenix, and let's pretend that in Phoenix, the average person is overweight on the national average by, say, 10 or 15 pounds. The average person is 10 to 15 pounds overweight. Well, let me tell you, weight control is way more complicated than any of us would like to believe. I mean, if it was simple, we'd all do it. So what can you do that is understandable and simple? Well, a little town of 37,000 people in West Virginia said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to run an ad in the paper and on television, just local, that just makes one point, drink 1%. And as they put the word drink 1% on the paper or on television, the other thing is squeezing 2.5 pieces of bacon into a whole glass of milk, whole milk. There's about 2.5 pieces of bacon of grease in that glass of whole milk. So drink 1% or drink whole milk. 1%. Or whole milk. That's all. That's all they did. Over and over. Drink 1%. You know, you see that so many times, and pretty soon, I can't take it anymore. I'll drink 1%. And lo and behold, it does change people's weight significantly. Just that one behavior. Keeping it more simple. Howard, South Dakota, got very weary, a town of 30,000, got very weary of everybody in Howard going to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 100 miles away and buying everything. They buy everything. You just always get in the car twice a week and you go to Sioux Falls and you buy all you're buying and you don't buy anything in Howard. And yet people in Howard trying to make money. So they had the high school economics class start writing little articles. They were featuring children, kids' articles every day, buy local, buy in Howard. Start buying, lo and behold. I mean, Howard is now thriving. Small little change. Start little, it always turns to big. Someone once saying the biggest thing in life is showing up. And there's truth to that. Show up. It's amazing what happens when you show up. Mandy and I have been in a home fellowship for almost 48 years. In 9 out of 10 of those evenings at 7 o'clock, at 6:30, we look at each other. We're busy. We've been traveling. We're tired. We're not going to go to home fellowship. And then you say, wait, Ron and Julie are going to be there. Ron and Julie depend on us staying there. We've been doing it for 16 years together about going. So we come. How do you think we feel when we drive home? Every time. Oh, we're so glad we went. Life is that way. If you go home to your home, most of you will not go to this kind of a home because just the age you're in, but you go home, everything is a mess. Every room is a mess. That doesn't happen to many of you anymore, but if you're have teenagers and kids, please, how do you keep a sense? So how do you do that? Choose one room, the smallest little bathroom. Clean the toilet, shine the mirror, mop, 5 minutes, shut the door. Clean room. You know what that does to you? Having one clean room so energizes you that you maybe want to clean the next biggest room. Start. So Wayne and I are constantly talking about searching for the bright spots, small steps, doable things. The development puzzle in Africa, as far as an economist, is kind of easy. It's kind of easy, especially if you're an economist from the United States. And you have 310 Indian tribes. 310 reservations where there's 4 million Indians, but at least 3 million Indians living on these reservations. And all you have to do is drive down Pima and look on the west side and then look to the east where the Indian reservation is and say, what is wrong with this picture? How can it be that 4 million Indians struggle so badly? They're energetic. They're capable. They're created in God's image. They've been giving a brain and all the rest. Why, oh, why, oh, why does the unemployment rate on the Indian reservation 3 times the unemployment rate of America as a whole? Why, oh why, would you have the death to alcohol 7 times the number as the average death to alcohol in the rest of America? And so all of those statistics, only half of the kids ever graduate from high school. Very few graduate from the university. Something is fundamentally wrong. And I tell you what, if you don't start where I'm going to start right now on that very first thing, is it's tribal ownership. Let me tell you, dear friends, tribal ownership, you can't get there from here. Socialism doesn't work. Everybody's business becomes nobody's business. Common ownership doesn't work. Collectivized agriculture does not work. The Soviets try it. The Chinese tries it. Everybody tries it. Collectivized agriculture does not work. Dad and I'll tell you what works. Put my dad and myself on a 160-acre farm and have us work our butts off 12, 15 hours a day. That works. And I tell you how many times as a kid growing up, and Dad would come, I would maybe just ride home from school, and Dad would say, get on the tractor, we gotta go up, the wind's blowing, and we gotta get some equipment out in there and bring that land down. We've gotta, it's gonna all blow away on us, friend. It's all gonna blow, we've gotta get in and work that and bring that land down. And so we did that. Why? Because it was our farm. Why? Because it was our responsibility. It was our business. If we don't make it, we starve. What an incentive. As turned to Soviet agriculture, the wind blows, the fields start blowing away. It's 5 o'clock. Not gonna work. That's when you really have to go to work, is between 5 o'clock and midnight, for crying out loud. So you see me say there, tribal ownership without private ownership. And then the real horrific problem of having collectivized agriculture or collectivized anything is you never build up collateralization. So Wayne and I, as we talk to president after president, prime minister after prime minister, leaders of a country after leaders of the country, friends, here's the problem. None of these people are able to collateralize, meaning build up some value in something they own. They need verifiable addresses. This is not hard to do. We can start getting that done immediately. Get verifiable addresses. We can start getting titles and deeds. That's the role of government, to title it, adjudicate property rights, say, this is yours. No, this is yours. That is what the court system is supposed to do, adjudicate property rights. But people need verifiable addresses, and when they get them, now they can maybe paint their house, maybe they can put on an extra this or an extra that and build up a little collateral. Now they can go to a bank and say, I need 50 bucks. If I could have 50 bucks, I tell you what, we could buy a sewing machine. And if we could buy a sewing machine, it's amazing what we could do in our household with a sewing machine as compared just to a needle and a thread. $50 could be a big deal. I'm not going to loan you. Okay, I'll loan you $50. What's your collateral? I don't have any. I not only don't have any collateral, I don't even have a verifiable address. So you say to the president and the prime ministers, please, please, we've got to get these people verifiable addresses. For crying out loud, come in. We'll put up your whole country on a map on the wall, as we did in Albania. Every stick of land in Albania, and we'll look and say, who owns what? And how are we going to get some ownership there? And how are we going to get some of that, those beaches leased to Four Seasons and to the Hyatt Regency and to the Ritz-Carlton, so that they can lease some of the most beautiful beaches in the whole world? They're empty. They're empty. No one's got them. No one's owned them. Well, the government owns it all. Well, we don't like to sell our land to foreigners. Don't sell it. Lease it. Ritz-Carlton will be happy to do a 30 or 50 year lease. And all of a sudden now, you've got some activity going. And all of a sudden, beaches are being used. And all of a sudden, the tourists start coming out. And said, I had no idea that Albania had these kind of beaches. So it all has to do here with collateralization and ownership. Do you view wealth created or transferred? See, the beautiful thing about the right view of wealth, wealth can be created. It's not fixed. It's not fixed. Oil used to be yucko, ugly, terrible. If you had any oil on your land, all of a sudden we put oil to a use. Wealth is growing. We only had so much natural gas 10 years ago, and we're running out, and gas prices were going up, and the supply of natural gas was going down. But 10 years ago, we figured out how to frack, how to drill 7,000 feet under the ground, turn it on a dime, a camera at the end of that bit. It looks at that shale down there. It fracks it with sand and water, releases gas. We now have the four largest gas fields in the world, America. I promise you something. We're going to have a presidential candidate of the United States that steps up in either 2012 or 2016. I don't know which will be the year, but I'd almost bet the farm that it'll be one of those two times, 2012, 2016, and he's going to stand up to America and says, look it, we formed a Department of Energy in 1977. Why? Because 20% of our oil was being imported in 1977. And we didn't want that kind of dependence on other countries. So we're going to form a Department of Energy to produce more energy. But our Department of Energy is not interested in producing energy at all. It's against it. So this is my poem. All coal is dirty, all nukes unsturdy, and dams all intervene. Let's go back to Neanderthal, where everything is green. Send us back! Green, clean, green, clean. Perfect! You're going to have a presidential candidate and say, North America can become the energy exporter continent of the world. We will make the Mideast look small compared to the kinds of energy that North America, United States, Canada, and Mexico can be exporting to the rest of the world. It's possible, it's doable, and it's there. Interestingly, not one of it comes up if you don't drill. You don't get any of it. Darn it. Okay. Create it, dear friends. Create it. So lastly, we got to shut this down. I'm already over time, aren't I? No? Oh, good. Okay. Good. So I'll grab that middle paragraph. Many see economic trade as a zero-sum game requiring a winner and a loser, rather than win-win, mutual gains from voluntary exchange. Now, is there always looters? Well, of course, creative destruction. Pretty soon, we don't have to produce typewriters anymore because we're into something all different than that. So there is creative destruction, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. But here's how God created us. God created us with limited needs and unlimited wants. Limited needs. God knows that you can, that our stomachs are only so big that you don't need infinite amounts of food and shelter and stuff, and we can make it. Those are our needs, and we have to have those. But for whatever reason, God has also made us human beings of unlimited wants. Now, why would God do that? That sounds like a consumer society to me. Unlimited ones. And it really is unlimited ones. Look at, some of you are wearing, as we speak, a Mickey Mouse watch. I've already seen one today. She wasn't very old, admittedly, only about 20 years old. A Mickey Mouse watch that costs about $20. It'll work. This is a $200 watch. It'll work. Some of you have thousands and two thousands dollar watches. It works. The Wall Street Journal this week had a nice, very nice wristwatch for $375,000. Yes! Now, if I'd have bought that wristwatch and be flashing it around today, my $375,000 watch, when I buy a $375,000 wristwatch, folks, it's not about time. What it's about, and you know it, and I know it, is, gosh, today if I, maybe I'll even not even wear a long sleeve shirt. And people pick that up. Not everybody, but they know a big expensive watch when they see one. And so what am I trying to do there? Gosh, maybe, just maybe, you'll think a little more of me. Well, there's one successful dude. Are you kidding me? See, isn't it odd? The very thing that we think might impress, do you know what we have found in our small group? That when we share our sin, the group loves us even more. Is that almost unbelievable? But it's true. It is true. So here you and I, we're walking in our Christian faith. Saints, saints, God doesn't see us as sinners anymore. He does not. He does not see our sin anymore. He does not see us that way anymore. We see ourselves that way. Saints, but we do sin. Get our sins out in front of us. Don't be quiet about it. As Jamie said to the men's retreat, men who are dealing with pornography, you're able to keep it silent and keep it quiet. It's eating your heart out. It's eating your guts out. It's eating your soul out. It's a poison. But I can't stop. I can't stop. I can't. Oh, yes, you can. Share it with a friend. Share it with a home fellowship. And I guess what? They're going to love you less. Oh, no! Ron and Julie, Mandy, did you hear that? We've been fellowshipping with Ron and Julie, and then, oh, for crying out loud, let's find another fellowship. Instead, we say, we love you more. You think people love you more because you show off a $300,000 wristwatch or drive a car or blah, blah, blah? See, now we're back to the point. The key to this whole door, what's the door we're talking about? Trust. What's this whole door? Faith. What's this whole door? Grace. What's this whole door? Love. What is all this about? Faith, trust, love, grace. What's that door? That door, you enter it in humility. What's humility? Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. And everything, look to Him, and He will direct your paths. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. And so Jesus teaches, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers. What is all of that about? Humility, isn't it? Isn't it? That's what Jesus says. So the key to the door is humility. But not you walk through the door and look, we're going to do something on humility today. Just watch me. No, of course not. See, but God does give us keys to watch ourselves. If we're trusting ourselves, i.e. not praying, i.e. not thinking about God, i.e. not for me to live as Christ, to die as gain, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. God is everything. Then we're trusting ourselves. So by definition, when you're trusting yourself, you're being selfish. You're trusting you. Get over that. Trust God. Trust God. Faith in God. A growing faith then allows you to say no to sin. Not because a teacher can manage it. Can't manage it in a million years. In fact, if we were all just going to talk mainly about sin and one particular kind of sin today, trust me, it would be worse this afternoon than it would be had we not even talked about it. Only God can give us the faith to say no to sin. Big views of God, little views of ourselves. God's Word is more authoritative than our words. That is the truth. God is supreme. We are not. He's the great I am. You and I are the little I am nots. Now, just because you and I are the little I am nots, that does not mean that we have to think less of ourselves. It does mean we could think of ourselves less. We're the little I am nots. It doesn't mean we have to stoop and be lower than we really are. We just have to stand next to a creator God who will show us the real smallness that we really are. We need Him. Just as an eagle needs thermals to soar, and a boat needs wind to sail, and a car needs gas to run, so do you and I need worship of the Almighty God. He is everything. He's the great I am. And when we take our little smallness and stand next to a great God, He shows us the little small smallness of our greatest greatness. He shows us. He shows us. Two more minutes, Ron? No? One more minute? Not even one. Okay? So, that second paragraph from the bottom, which we were going to spend most of the time on today. No, I'm serious. I wanted to. So you just get to hear the sentence and we're done. How do they view money in Africa? Use it or lose it. They don't. You have $100? That's not fair. That's not equal. They'll either share it or they'll steal it. Because we're all going to be equal. Use it or lose it. First need has first claim. Crazy, but that's how it works. No personal budgeting. Hoarding is antisocial. Saving, non-existent. Saving? Non-existent? How do you build up collateral? How are you ever going to make anything happen in your country? When you don't save, nobody saves? No, nobody saves. Minimal concern for accounting, good bookkeeping. They're uncomfortable with wealth. They're comfortable with equality and sharing. Their most families are in debt and overextended. And they're always concerned with face, shame, and honor. I was with Fred Beasley this week. I said, Fred, how is it over there in Tanzania? And he says, one of my best friends in Tanzania, they'll say, we'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow comes and they had no intention of doing it tomorrow. So these are deep, deep, enculturated values in a whole continent. And you start one person at a tribe and one tribe at a tribe and one little village at a time, and you just keep hiking. The main thing is to keep the main thing, Jesus. Only Jesus can change a culture. We can't, nobody can. Only Jesus. If Jesus doesn't want to, that's fine. That's fine. Let's pray. Father, be with precious Wayne and Margaret today. Thank you for a class that I know there's a little grumping when they get here and say, oh, no, Wayne is not here. None of us know why Wayne would ask me to replace him. I thank you for that privilege, and I enjoy doing it. Thanks for the blessing and for what you're going to do in our church as we study Philippians and to begin to actualize what we know to be positional truth, the truth that you love us, that we're saved by grace, that there's nothing that can snatch us out of your hands, there's nothing that we can do that would make you love us more, and nothing that we don't do that would make you love us less. Oh God, we are privileged men and women indeed to be sons and daughters of the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, and we love you. We love you. Amen. Thanks.